Being able to partner on research, when you think about how it rolls into diplomacy, having several nations on the same paper saying the same thing in the same, you know, in the same, when I say the same language, I mean how they describe the problem.
Yes.
That's really powerful. So, you know, if you have Korea and the UK describing a particular problem, that's not just the UK's view of this. It adds a real weight.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of Beyond the Ice. My name is Em Newton, and this is the podcast from British Antarctic Survey, where our experts brief you on newsworthy polar and climate science. Today, we're taking you behind the scenes of polar international relations. As our geopolitical reality grows more unstable, interest in Earth's polar regions is growing. To the north, changes to Arctic sea ice stand to open up Arctic travel, and Greenland finds itself in the spotlight over defence and natural resources. But to the south, interest also grows in Antarctica's fisheries and its potential natural resources. So in this context, the collaborative spirit and achievements of polar science are growing all the more important. Antarctica is governed internationally and cooperatively through the Antarctic Treaty, and it has been since 1959. That's an agreement which suspends territorial claims and preserves Antarctica for peace and science. This collaborative spirit is woven through how the Antarctic science community operates, whether that is fuel or travel or supporting other nations with medical evacuations. I'm joined by British Antarctic Survey's Director of Operations, Engineering and Infrastructure, Ollie Dark. We're going to talk about what international collaboration in Antarctica looks like on the ground and how this fits into today's global context. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
Great to be here.
Okay, so to start us off, can you explain what your job is in the context of the work of British Antarctic Survey?
Sure. So the British Antarctic Survey, for me, in its simplest form, is a UK environmental science organisation that specialises in what I'll describe as the cryosphere. So everything where water is in its solid form as ice. So obviously we have a bias in the Antarctic, but we also operate in the Arctic, in mountainous regions, anywhere you can expect to find ice. That's our niche. We operate research stations in the Antarctic and the subantarctic. We also operate a research station in the Arctic, and we have the Sir David Attenborough, and we operate a fleet of 5 aircraft, and they can go all over the world, wherever our expertise can be best applied. My role is Director of Polar Operations, Engineering and Infrastructure, and my job, in a simple sense, is to bring a team of experts together, try and ensure they have the right skills, equipment, infrastructure, all in the right place at the right time, in the right form, to enable the UK to deliver on its strategic interests and for BAS to deliver on its interests from a research perspective.
Yeah, so no big deal just going to some of the kind of hardest to be in environments in the world and trying to keep everyone safe whilst they're doing it.
Absolutely, but doing difficult things, is, as long as it's really important, that's great. We're right up for that.
Incredible. So you're obviously working kind of at the coalface of how actually getting people into Antarctica works. And I think by necessity, that has to include talking to other nations, working with other nations, and being aware of what other nations are doing to enter that space themselves. So first, can we talk about how Antarctica actually works from a policy perspective? Antarctica is governed under the Antarctic Treaty System. What does that look like in terms of actual meetings and decision-making spaces?
So the Antarctic Treaty System in my world, the way I contribute to it, is I'm a member of the UK delegation to the Antarctic Treaty, and we work towards the Antarctic Treaty consultative meeting over the course of the whole year. But then once a year, we get together for 2 weeks, really intense, and we work together on a whole range of business. You have to do a huge amount of reading in advance because all nations are putting together their version of what good looks like and their version of what success looks like. And you contribute, of course, like I say, a huge range of topics. And in my space, that's being advice to the UK delegation on things like safety, fieldwork, shipping operations, aircraft operations, operating research stations, these kind of topics. And the delegation has different experts for different themes. There's a tourism expert, there's a science expert, which is Jane Francis. And then you support policymakers, diplomats and lawyers effectively from the UK who drive the UK position on a number of topics. The other side of what I do is for an organization which is also part of the treaty system, but it's called COMNAP, and it's slightly different. So that's the Council of Managers of National Antarctic Programs, and I'm a vice chair for COMNAP. So our role there is, it's chalk and cheese. You still sit in a big room behind the UK flag, and you still have the kind of pomp and ceremony bit, but the way you go about your business is completely different. The meeting isn't run by diplomats and lawyers, and that changes the tone of the room, and it's driven by people that operate facilities and equipment in Antarctica. So it's all about collaboration. It's absolutely about creating a big, innovative pool of experts that come together to work out, well, the UK solves this problem a bit like this. How does Korea solve this problem? How does Germany solve this problem? And it leads to this really exciting melting pot where you realise that, oh, actually, we thought we were quite good in that space, but actually, no, somebody over here in Australia is doing a much better job than us. And you can get to work together and come up with these really, sometimes quirky, but often really pragmatic ways of solving chunky problems in Antarctica that ultimately allow us to do more research and to do it in a way that's more cost effective and less environmentally impactful.
That's so interesting that there's this contrasting character between the two rooms, and that kind of the science and operations environment feels a little bit more free and less kind of weighed down by the political space. What was it like for the first time going into the political Antarctic Treaty meeting?
It is exactly like that. So my role ends up as this kind of interface between the doers, who are super pragmatic innovators, and then the diplomats. And I try and translate in both directions to help them both do their jobs, because it's all really important work. It's just different. And the first time I went to a treaty meeting, it was fascinating in that I knew it would be a relatively formal environment because we'd done all the preparation work in advance and done all the huge amounts of reading and preparation and writing and things like that. But when you walk into the room for the first time, there's a feeling at the start of these kind of, it's 2 weeks of meetings. There's two meeting rooms at a treaty meeting, one for the Committee of Environmental Protection and the other for the main treaty meeting. And together, they're about the size of a football pitch. They're enormous. And there's a couple of hundred people maybe in the treaty room, where all there's nearly 60 delegations from nations plus different organizations around the outside, and each nation largely has, you know, five or six people in their delegation. So it's a big space and very, very formal. And at first touch point, it's massively intimidating. But once you get into the kind of the rhythm of getting business done, you build confidence quite quickly. And ultimately, they're all really friendly people behind the ties and behind the stern faces. Yes. They're all really experienced people that want to get things done.
Of course. But
it's just a totally different way of going about business.
Yeah, exactly. They're all people, but they're having to come as representatives. And
exactly.
Everyone's got their position that they have to represent.
Yeah, exactly. And when you make your, particularly when I made my first intervention, they call it, when you hit the button and you call for the floor.
Oh.
Yeah, it sounds super formal because it is, right? But you're sat in the chair for the first time. And this is where you've got to work with great leaders that push you out your comfort zone. Because I sat in the chair for the first time. It was an interesting topic, but I can't remember what it was. And this was when the head of the UK delegation just leans over my shoulder and says, "You should say something about this," and hit the button.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
So you didn't hit the button.
Yeah, I didn't even hit it. So then before you know it, the floor is yours. There's all cameras. They point at you. Your face is all on the screen.
Oh, wow. Okay. So
everybody stares at you. And then you're also, there's four official languages of the treaty. So what you're saying is also being translated. So when you're speaking, you've got the languages going on in your head. At the same time, you have to take your headphones off. It's really like, make a bit of a fuss of the first attempt. But once you get through that, you realize that fundamentally, these are people just trying to get things done and try and protect the kind of core principles of the treaty. And then you're away after that. You've got to make a bit of a fool of yourself at some point, but then you get stuck in and you're away.
Yeah, I'm sure they knew they just had to push you off the edge until you were going. Yeah.
Otherwise, you just sit there scared of the button.
Yeah, of course. What kind of issues, can you give us a flavour? What are all of those countries coming together to try and decide or push through?
Oh, it's hugely varied. So at the treaty meeting itself, there'll be everything from protection of emperor penguins through to implementation of the Polar Code, which is a framework for safe shipping in the Southern Ocean, all the way through to controlling airspace within Antarctica, all the way through to sustainability initiatives, all sorts of things. So in the last couple of years, I've been pushing some work that Bass has been doing on alternative fuels and using hydrotreated vegetable oil to run our ship, and trying to at least promote that there are different ways of doing things and to try and encourage choice. This is not a the treaty is based on consensus, and these topics like using alternative fuels will always have differing views in that room. So it's not necessarily about trying to force it through where consensus is the only version of success. Some of these things are slightly more subtle than that. It's about actually trying to communicate that BASS is doing loads of work to try and work in different ways for generally positive outcomes. Let's share that information with the community and try and create some choice. And who knows? You know, not everything needs to be written in law to change. Some of it is about societal change, and some of it's about enabling operators to think differently and just giving them the tools to go and make the call for themselves and being more informed.
Are there ever conflicts in terms of how the managers of the kind of various polar programs want to work and how then that plays out in a political context?
ComNap, no, you don't see that, because ultimately they still have the choice to go and do it in their own way anyway, right? So it's more about influencing. And for the treaty, you don't see it so overtly because you've got lots of working groups in the background that kind of work towards, you know, shared goals. But what you will see is you'll see a lack of consensus. And that effectively, to me, is a sign that actually we've just got more work to do in this space to find middle ground to keep us moving. It's big, challenging topics out there that we're trying to cover.
So for the treaty bit, you've got this huge kind of, you've said football pitch sized room, you've got the cameras, you've got the buttons. Is that the same mood that carries over to ComNap?
No, it's really different. So you still have the, like I say, you sit in front of a flag, you represent the UK, but at ComNap, you're BASS, you're not the UK in the same sense. You've still got the same challenges on nations wanting to work in different ways, but there's practical hurdles that exist, but also barriers that are removed in that space. So a practical hurdle that exists is there are 19 first languages in the ComNap environment, and there are no interpreters.
Oh, okay, great.
So it's always important, I think, to remind myself, and it's the same for treaty, actually, in that being an English speaker is just this huge advantage in these scenarios, because English is often the common language that people try to work to. But you're sat in a room where you're speaking your first language, and everybody else is either on their second or third language. And it's, you've got to be patient, and you find yourself, particularly when you get in a room where it's the UK, Australia, USA, Korea, India and others, that Australia, US and UK don't end up speaking in their own almost slang that nobody's following, speaking really, really quickly. And you can lose the room quite quickly. And all of a sudden you think, okay, so why have I managed to make such great progress with these nations, but not these? And sometimes it's the really obvious stuff that actually, have I lost these people along the way? Have I been speaking too quickly? Have I not written things down in advance in a way that they can kind of digest in slightly slower time because I've got to translate it three times in their mind?
Well, that's interesting.
You end up thinking, I've done some great deals with US, Australia, the Kiwis and others. And it's like, why haven't I quite managed to get these other things over the line?
What do these countries have in common?
And it's often like the simplest answer usually sticks. It's just actually, well, let's take a step back, let's slow down, and let's think about, is this how they like to do business? Do they do it over a cup of tea, or would they like to take it slightly slower, or do it over breakfast, or would they like us to write it down rather than just have a conversation? There's loads of ways that, and the Foreign Office are great at providing like basic advice, right? So like before this year's treaty meetings in Hiroshima, and they're putting on, the Japan desk at the Foreign Office are putting on a training session for us about like how to do business in Japan to try and help us.
And the etiquette of it.
It's like, it's only an hour where they give you a brief or something, but next year it'll be Korea, and it's nothing, there's no state secrets exchange. It's just, this is how you go about doing business in these countries in the most effective way possible, ideally without offending everybody.
Well, this is the kind of work of diplomats, full stop, isn't it? A lot of the time it is just kind of building relationships with people where you have different approaches to meetings and different approaches to manners.
Exactly. But even when I talk to colleagues at the Foreign Office, often they get posted to a desk for a given period. So they get, for example, they'll get really good at Latin America countries, or they'll be really good at in Mexico specifically because that's their desk. Whereas in the Antarctic space, with the treaty, the host nation changes every year and rotates around the world. And you've got effectively, which is a huge privilege, almost 60 nations to go at as far as building relationships and making collaborations with. So you're almost spoilt for choice, and you've got to find a ways of thinking, okay, so I'm going to work with the US today, the Chinese delegation tomorrow, and adjust your style. And it's a great leadership test to be able to work in different ways. I find it a brilliant challenge.
Do you find that you ever get the kind of seeds of things that bear out in reality there? Because, for instance, BASS has got a new partnership with the German programme and the Norwegian programme on logistics. Did that have its seeds in in-person meetings?
Oh, absolutely. And sometimes even over a beer where you can talk about, like, you know, what's not working, you know, and you can go and build relationship with people. Because all of these partnerships, they start from a position of high trust. Mm. Because if you're going to, particularly for the relationship with Norway and Germany on sharing logistics, we've effectively pooled the success of three seasons south into one vessel. So we're all in this together. And if it fails because of one of us, we've let the other two partners down. And, you know, Troll Station all of a sudden doesn't have its baked beans, or they're probably only baked beans, but
they're equivalent of
baked beans and crumpets. They're not delivered because of something that we've done together. Yeah. So you have to start from the position of high trust. You have to have a position where you can communicate effectively. Mm. And starting through 1,000 small things at events like ComNap are a really great way to make that happen. Because although in practice you could all get together and write the most fantastic MOU that lawyers could draw together for you, in practice there's got to be a will and a drive to think, actually, the UK would be a great partner to go and help us solve this particular thing. And in the case of shipping, it's really fundamental stuff. So, like, ultimately, work in Antarctica is massively expensive. And if you allow it to be, it has a massive environmental impact because of shipping. That industry is yet to catch up with alternative fuels. It's on a journey, but it's not there yet. And the easiest way you can innovate, you can do engineering solutions, but sometimes the simplest answers are the best, which is, oh, actually, why are we all three nations sending big cargo ships from Europe to Antarctica every year when we could share one?
Yes, you know, a similar area, often travelling through each other's stations as well.
Yeah, not very, very often, but, you know, it doesn't, logic doesn't always work out like that. Yeah. Sometimes you've got to have the right characters in the right space at the right time to say, look, guys, this is crazy. We've got to find a way to work together here, because we could all be directing our effort and our money in other ways. And for BASS, for example, Halley is right on the eastern edge of British Antarctic Territory. Yeah. So it's a good 7 to 10 days from what I would describe as normal operating theatre on the Antarctic Peninsula. And by sharing logistics into Halley, doesn't just mean that we save money and carbon. It means we can retask the SDA, which means we can go and do more brilliant research, because the choice then becomes go and deliver toilet roll and baked beans to Halley and some fuel, or go and do this research program. And if we can find new ways to work, it feels like a no-brainer, but you've got to do all the hard stuff first to get to that point where at some point it becomes a bit of there's a spark, and you think, okay, this is actually going to come off. Yeah. You know, this actually feels like it's going to be a success.
I think it's also interesting with this example, particularly, there's an expertise aspect. So for context, Halley Research Station is on the Brunt Ice Shelf, which is a flowing kind of glacier ice shelf. And I don't know, how fast Brunt flows?
At the moment, it's about 4 metres a day.
Yeah, and then so in order to restock this station, you're bringing a ship up to the kind of sheer ice face at where it kind of meets the sea, out to open sea in the Southern Ocean. And there's a whole process of actually how can you safely offload onto an ice cliff effectively, and identifying the position and what's called grooming the berth. So it's such a strange phrase, but I quite enjoy it. My understanding is that this partnership also really leans on the combined expertise of what it's like to do that really specific operation, which is actually quite dangerous.
Oh, absolutely. There's big parts of what we do in Antarctica that are inherently very hazardous, that unless you get really good at it, you can make some mistakes that have really, really high consequences. But it's really important. So we have to find ways of doing these things safely. And particularly for BASS, in the example of the Brunt Ice Shelf, you can, without organisations like ComNap and without working with other nations, you can get into a position where you think you're so niche, you're the only one solving this problem in the whole world. When in reality, you've got neighbours. They're a long way away, but they're also solving this ice shelf relief challenge. And when you do these things only once every 2-3 years, it's really hard to keep those skills within a team and keep them really effective. So by being able to share, we learn a bit from Norway, we learn a bit from Germany, they learn a bit from us. We can keep our skills really current and, you know, be more effective in the process. And hopefully the plan is to be much safer as a consequence, because we're all learning.
Amazing. presumably once you start collaborating with other nations, other opportunities arise out of that. You can see other possibilities for kind of synergy, or, oh, that person's really great at this particular thing. What can we learn from that?
Absolutely. There's a cascading impact that how I describe it to myself. So I almost put it into three. So firstly, you've got to have a really clear view of what the problem is you're trying to solve and what a shared view of success looks like, and then try and communicate that to other partners. And often at that early stage, it's really, really pragmatic stuff. Save money, save carbon, be able to retask your assets. The second piece for me is that culture of innovation within BAS itself. We need to do more and continually work at BAS's, what I would describe as one of its greatest strengths, of its ability to innovate and its ability to think differently and its ability to build relationships across the world. So by us doing something like chunky, like being able to share a ship, actually what that means is for the next 10 years that German, Norwegian and BAS researchers will be sharing berths on a ship, they'll be sharing breakfast, lunch and dinner together, they'll be doing things together, and we'll have, whether that's field guides or engineers or glaciologists, they'll be in the same place at the same time, all under this umbrella of collaboration and building partnerships with other nations is a good thing. How are we going to build that? And you never know where it's going to go. Yeah. That's what the great thing about creating a culture is. You try and build the foundations and then just let the team run away with it and see where it builds. Like, for example, the early days of the internet is one example. That's Tim Berners in the late 80s, who was working as researchers with CERN.
Yeah.
And they just wanted to solve this really basic problem, which is how to move information and research between the different nations within CERN. And that's how the internet started.
Is that actually true?
Yeah. So all it was a CERN project. They created a project within the project to create a way of sharing research packages, bits of work, data between the different nations of CERN.
Yeah.
They figured that out. They made it freely available. And then that became the foundation of what is now like the internet economy. And it changed everything. Oh. All because of this like really humble beginnings of just, let's try and find a way of solving this problem together, even if it's, you know, it's a bit boring. You know, like to some people, you know, shared logistics is boring, but you never know. You never know where these things go.
Oh, thanks, CERN. Okay, cool. So what is your equivalent currently of building the next World Wide Web?
Oh, crikey. I'd be a rich man if I knew. But that's the great thing that I get really excited about, is that I try and, you know, and the whole team at BAS does, you try and create these partnerships in full knowledge that actually what you're doing is creating an organizational culture that's really pro innovation and really pro building relationships. And if you read things like the UK innovation strategy, it wants to be a global leader and it wants to be international first. These are the ambitions of the UK, and this is our way of aligning BAS to that strategy, to say, actually, you know, we're going to be a global player. We want to be and to continue to be a leader in this space. And we know an organization of our size and with the complexity and challenges of somewhere as big as Antarctica, you know, it's twice the size of Australia, you're not going to do that on your own. And you've got to think, okay, so how do we make the biggest global impact possible? And that's got to be through building relationships.
Yeah, of course. So given the kind of early success of the Germany-Norway collaboration, is there anything else coming up for BAS that you can talk about?
So the next big thing for BAS is how we work around the Antarctic Peninsula. And there are a few things that are changing there. So what's possible for us will change as far as our toys in theatre go. But also climate change is having this fundamental impact on what is possible on the Antarctic Peninsula. So look, going back maybe 5-10 years, we would consider it a real success if we'd got our vessel alongside at Rothera on the berth by Christmas or by early December. We'd think that was a real win because of the huge sea ice extent that you'd get every winter. It would effectively close Rothera off from shipping during that period. Whereas now, and for the last 3 or 4 years, we could have had the SDA at Rothera almost 12 months of the year.
Yeah.
The sea ice extent is so small. You can start to ask yourself some really big questions, like why do we send people there for 18 months when you can just have a supply chain that's, you know, a ship every month or something? Why do we go back? Are there big science questions that we could answer during the Antarctic winter? So in 2024, we tested this principle by having the SDA in theatre, and we did our first midwinter with the SDA was in on the Antarctic Peninsula for midwinter, and that's the first UK vessel in Antarctica for more winter since Shackleton's Endurance.
Yeah, that's nuts, isn't it?
It's crazy. And we brought our ship
100
back.
100 years?
Oh, yeah, yeah, at least. Yeah. And some. And that's as much about how shipping has changed and as much about, but it's climate change. And it's perverse, but there's an opportunity there in that we need to think about how we as an organization, park the science for one moment, is how are we going to change the way we deliver our business? Because our context is completely changing. Can we do more research in the winter? Are there big questions that the scientists currently aren't asking because they think it's not possible to go and do it? And it's my job and my team's job to say, no, actually, the things are changing in a way that actually, if you want to go and do an August, July marine science cruise in the Southern Ocean, you can absolutely go and do that.
I think working in VAT, you really get a sense of the pace that people work at. And then when you kind of get into the field season, when people are in Antarctica, there's a real sense of tempo. Like people are in, they've got their 2 weeks or month or 6 weeks to collect the data that they then need, that they'll base years of research on. And in turn, other people are doing projects which will then piggyback off that data. So all data in Antarctica is really hard won. So it's really interesting to kind of have this perspective shift on how accessible Antarctica is, for better or for worse.
And it's changing. And it will change it will ebb and flow, over the years to come. And some things that we do will become more difficult. So accessing some of the mountainous regions in the Northern Peninsula area, for the last 60 years, we've accessed those areas via Twin Otter. And because of what they describe as Greenlandification of the Northern Peninsula, accessing those areas that are really interesting from a research perspective, because they're changing really fast, right? You can usually follow the breadcrumbs, but accessing it is getting more difficult. So we've got to, again, find a way of thinking about that differently. Does that mean that BAS needs to partner with nations that have helicopters based on their research vessels so we can access these kind of new, interesting areas, but make sure we continue to do it in a safe way? Because it will continue to, like I say, ebb and flow. Opportunities will come, issues will arise. And what's really difficult is trying to foresee what that pace of change might look like. At the moment, we're slightly too close to the rearview mirror and spotting it after the fact. But that's the pace of change. We didn't see, climate scientists didn't see this kind of acceleration of change on the peninsula coming to us as fast as it has.
Well, even on an anecdotal level, you'll have people who have been at BAS for a number of years who have been south, and they will talk about in the winter taking a skidoo out over sea ice to local islands. And people this year have said the sea ice didn't really form thickly enough to kind of access that at all.
Yeah.
So it's kind of at an anecdotal, personal level, there's people in this organisation who have a totally different experience of what winter in Antarctica looks like, which I think really puts a point on how fast things are changing.
Oh, absolutely. I go through the Met data for Rothera for last year, and August is obviously the coldest month, but -5.
Oh, wow.
And in January and February, we're seeing rain at Rothera, and we're having to adapt building design for the hangar and elsewhere, because we know that the climate is changing in a way that we need to think really differently. And in some sections of what we do, there'll be losers in that regard, where life will just get more complicated. It'll be more difficult to do it in that way. And then, a bit like shipping, there'll be winners in that actually it's much cheaper and easier to take ships to Rothera for more of the year than it ever used to be. And it doesn't have to be the best ship. It could be partners again. It could be that the next step for us is working with other peninsular nations like Chile, US, Argentina. It's almost endless number of peninsular nations that provide shipping in that Northern Peninsula area, and BAS could partner with any one of them. And I think that will happen.
I think it's really interesting on top of this just to note that at Rothera Research Station, which is on the peninsula, even within that community there is a kind of lot of international collaboration already. So there is a Dutch lab space that's kind of built into the footprint of Rothera, and that's an ongoing collaboration between kind of Dutch research councils and the UK. We have a runway that facilitates a lot of access kind of for international parties into deeper parts of Antarctica. So the state of normality for people on station at Rothera is that you are seeing other international parties and they're waving them on their way. So there's a kind of casual normality to how people work together in polar science, because it is this extreme environment where to see another group of people, you're like, hooray, welcome.
Yeah, absolutely. And people love it. It's part of our DNA of getting things done in Antarctica. And I think partly because Antarctica has been relatively well protected by the treaty system from geopolitical excitement over the years, but mainly because of the culture that the people that work in the polar regions create for themselves, that they know that ultimately that one day something really serious might happen and you might be completely reliant on your neighbour. And it all the way from the guys delivering the work down at Rothera or wherever, all the way to the tops of the different National Antarctic programmes, that culture of we're here to support each other and let's solve problems together, that is really, really strong. And that's, for me, a reason to be optimistic.
Yeah, completely. There is a phrase that science is a tool of diplomacy. Do you think that kind of bears out in Antarctic science?
Absolutely. Even with the Bass example, if you think about the hole in the ozone, in the 80s, found by Bass scientists that eventually led on to the Montreal Protocol, which for me is one of the best examples of an environmental treaty ever.
It's probably the most successful at this point, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And it's fantastic. And there's a thousand small examples underneath that of genuine change happening because of small collaborations elsewhere. And science is a great leveler, because if you think about how to create societal change, you've got to create a shared language and a shared view of expertise. Science does that for you.
Yeah, completely. And just to shout out, even just in the last month, we've had the Bass hot water drilling team out with the Korean Polar Institute on Thwaites Glacier. There's scientists from Bass who are currently on the Polar Stern doing work around surface air fluxes. So that kind of attitude of partnership really does permeate all of science and nowhere more than in polar science.
And being able to partner on research, when you think about how it rolls into diplomacy, having several nations on the same paper saying the same thing in the same, you know, in the same, when I say the same language, I mean how they describe the problem.
Yes.
That's really powerful. So, you know, if you have, you know, Korea and the UK describing a particular problem, that's not just the UK's view of this. It adds a real weight.
Yeah, that is the consensus. And then useful, I think, in turn to diplomats, for whom often it is a question of language and getting a kind of a legal agreement on paper.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at the current geopolitical climate, do you think international collaboration in Antarctica is becoming more important or more difficult, or a kind of combination of both?
It always has been important, and I think it always will be important because Antarctica is an extremely difficult place to do anything. So it will be a reality that the vast majority of nations are not equipped to do everything on their own under all circumstances. So you're going to have to collaborate. And that's purely an operational level, scientifically, absolutely too. As far as where I think it's getting more difficult, no, I don't think so, not in my experience. I think it's always been quite hard because aligning the views of different nations that want to tackle different things in different ways has always required lots of work, and it still requires lots of effort, but it's incredibly important and it's well worth it. And you won't get every one of these things over the line, and they won't all lead to the internet, for example.
Yeah.
But it's a really important work, and you've got to, if you want to create an economy or an organization around high innovation that comes up with the next big idea, you've got to go and take some risks in these spaces, go and build the relationships, go and talk about the really difficult problems that you've got to find a way of solving that currently you can't do on your own.
Yeah. Obviously, there's a lot of interest in the possibilities of Antarctica from a territory point of view, from a resources point of view. But the Antarctic Treaty is there to kind of suspend those claims, and it's held up since 1959.
Mm-hmm.
So I think you can only continue to participate in that space as a function of getting it to keep going. The instability that we see around the world, your best bet is to continue to be present in those spaces and building that consensus in those spaces.
Yeah. And for national Antarctic programs, you've got to look at the treaty. Well, for me personally, you've got to look at the treaty and it's like its core fundamental objectives, which is to have an entire continent free of military activity.
Mm.
And it's the only continent that's been free of conflict ever. I mean, if you try to write that treaty today, it'll be unbelievably challenging, and whether you'd achieve it or not, you know, everybody would have their own view. But I think you've got to make sure for me and for I think for Bass, is that you don't create a race to the bottom where success is the absence of a negative.
Mm.
You know, we've got to think relatively positively and keep putting examples out there of collaboration and scientific endeavor in difficult places like Antarctica, into the global discourse and say, look, no, these things are possible and it's working. And I think the exploitation piece will always kind of be out there in the background. But for us, for our role, it's got to be delivering the most impactful science possible, collaborating in as many exciting, impactful ways as possible, and then go and communicate it. Yeah. Go and tell the world that actually working in Antarctica is really easy when we work together. And that's all sorts of nations from all corners of the globe that doing difficult but important things in Antarctica is only possible because we work together.
Yeah, amazing. There's the eternal question of what value does it have to the UK taxpayer to be spending money sending people to the other side of the world? I mean, hopefully the answer is kind of in evidence if you've listened to this conversation, but what would you say if someone was like, what is this doing for me?
The UK innovation strategy, which is what the current government wants to base our entire economy against, is about being a global leader and building impactful global relationships that effectively will impact trade and it'll impact our economic performance. In order to do that, you've got to go out there and do really difficult things that have a global impact that can make a positive contribution to problems other than our own. Because if you want to have an economy based on trade, you've got to go and help other nations and create IP and create industries and create expertise within the UK that other nations want to access.
Yeah.
And for us, some of that will be our scientific expertise in understanding our climate and how what happens in Antarctica doesn't stay in Antarctica. But it's also about engineering and innovation and the space industry, and all of these things have links into Antarctica that will absolutely pay dividends to us in the UK. It's just, you might not feel it directly, but it's absolutely there.
Yeah. So not to toot your own horn, but the UK is actually really great at polar science and polar logistics.
Yeah, it's really good at it. And it's been good at it for a while.
I think that's a lovely note to end on. Thank you for coming on the podcast.
No, cheers. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Beyond the Ice. I hope you found that as interesting as I did. In case you didn't know, Beyond the Ice is also available as a quick read article. We have this as a newsletter on LinkedIn and as a feature on the British Antarctic Survey website. Speaking of LinkedIn, that is also the best way to send us suggestions for topics and questions you'd like us to explore on this podcast. Just search for the Beyond the Ice newsletter on LinkedIn and comment on this episode to get your question into contention. See you next time.